That, I'd like to turn to our third speaker. The scope of our discussion today started out looking very broadly at health reform and the impacts on the safety net, and then we looked at the hospital focus, and now we're going to look at the community health center focus. Michelle Proser is the Director of Research at the National Association of Community Health Centers, where she conducts extensive research and writing on health centers, access to and quality of care issues, health disparities, quality improvement, and other issues related to the medically underserved. She is responsible for analyzing data from all federally qualified health centers as well as other data sources, and she coordinates activities that promote community-based participatory research as a tool for improving community health. She received her master's in public policy from George Washington University and is currently working on her doctorate in public policy at that same institution. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Proser.
Almost there.
Thank you. Not quite, doctor. Well, thank you. We're actually very excited to be here. This is actually my first APHA conference, and it's been actually a very interesting experience. Community health centers like to see ourselves as the linkage between public health and the medical community, so we're thrilled to be here. So with that, let me just jump on in. Oh, I have nothing to disclose. Let me tell you a little bit about NAC. So our mission is to promote the provision of high-quality, comprehensive, and affordable health care that is coordinated and culturally and linguistically appropriate to the communities they serve, and that care is actually directed by the communities they serve. So in serving out that mission, we represent the National Network of Community, Migrant, Homeless, and Public Housing Health Centers, all part of Section 330 of the Public Health Service Act. We're also known as federally qualified health centers. So a quick history, we were started in the 1960s. I say we because when I started at NAC 7 years ago, I quickly discovered that the health center program is not really a program, it's actually a movement. So it's a very exciting thing to be a part of. But here are pictures of the two individuals that actually started the Community Health Center program here in this country, Drs. Jack Iger and Count Gibson. It was based on a community-oriented primary care model out of South Africa. And they were designed to be sort of twofold purpose, to be agents of care in communities without any access to health care, and agents of change, giving communities direction of the care they receive. So every health center is different, but they all have the same core requirements that are actually based in their federal mandates. They must be located in or serve federally designated medically underserved areas or populations. They actually work through a broad definition of health to really actually address those social determinants of health that are the root causes of poor health. Comprehensive patient and community-centered care is a very big part of what they do. Also very unique in the Community Health Center program is they're required to be governed by a governing board that's made up of at least 51% of that board has to be patients, actual consumers. In the days before HIPAA, the federal government would do their site visits and actually pull records to make sure that they were actually part of the health center, the active patients of the health center. So it's a very, very important part of our program and the source of what we think is the source of our strength. Ongoing needs assessments and quality improvement, they're required to conduct very regular and formalized needs assessments of their community. And of course, they're nonprofits. About 5% of health centers actually are, like Denver Health, part of a public entity, so like a public health department. But they're all nonprofit, and they're required to be open to all patients regardless of ability to pay. Today, health centers nationally serve about 20 million patients. Because of their structure, they disproportionately serve patients that are poor, uninsured, or publicly insured, minority, and sicker than the general population. We serve about a million migrant farm workers, and we also serve about a million homeless patients nationally as well. Health centers are located in every state and territory. And actually, that should be about 8,000 sites now across the country. A lot of health centers are also forming what's called health center controlled networks. They receive a small sum of money from HRSA to actually pull resources together to employ, for example, health information technology strategies or for managed care contracting or so on. But I want to say it's about somewhere between 10, I think it's about 15% of all health center patients are actually served through individual health centers that are part of horizontally integrated networks. Just a quick slide of the types of services Health Center provide. We do provide a large number of dental and oral health service, dental and behavioral health services, and also enabling services. So our staff is pretty diverse. Obviously, we have a large number of clinical staff, traditionally primary care clinical staff, physicians, NPs, PAs, nurses, and others. But we also have dentists, dental hygienists, licensed clinical social workers, case managers, promotoras, and so on. What I wish I had put in the slide is the growing number of patients with chronic illness. We're actually seeing that the number of patients with chronic illness is rising a lot faster than the number of patients nationally. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about what health centers are going to receive out of the Health Care Reform Act. And you know, we have good feelings that we're still going to see this happen despite the recent elections. A lot of this Dr. Biedman has already spoken to, but health centers actually received a designated direct fund source called the Health Center Trust Fund that will provide health centers $11 billion over 5 years. Most of that will go into operations to expand services to new sites or new communities or the provision of new services. For example, if they didn't have on-site behavioral health care, now they can expand. Some of that money is also for capital purposes, for renovating and building new facilities, but also for acquiring health information technology. This is just a quick breakdown of how that fund will break out over the 5 years. And this is our estimate on how many patients we'll be able to reach. So you'll notice that we're anticipating a doubling over the next 5 years. And in the small print, how we came up with this estimate, we'll talk about that a little bit more when I get to the challenge section at the end of the presentation. There's also been dedicated funding for important health workforce programs that bring providers to medically underserved areas, including community health centers. For example, the National Health Service Corps, that'll bring about 15,000 new providers in underserved areas over the next 5 years. And also a new dedicated stream of funding, grant funding out of Title VII, to create teaching health centers. So allow health centers to develop residency training programs for physicians, I should say. It's not just family physicians. It can also be for dentists and others. And that's actually a very important program because we find that clinicians that train in medically underserved communities and safety net providers are more likely to serve those communities. Some other key provisions in the ACA, the exchange, we're anticipating that a lot of our currently uninsured patients will actually be able to benefit from the exchange. So the exchange plans are must contract with community health centers, and they must guarantee a certain amount of payment to health centers. Their payment system will be based on our current Medicaid payment system, which is a prospective payment system. I can't call it enhanced payment because what we find is that although it's fair, in theory, intended to be fair payment to cover the cost of our care, what we know from the financial data that health centers report, it's not quite 100% of their costs, it's 85% of their costs or so on, but it's still health centers' most important and reliable paying source. Also, Medicare payments. Currently, I think starting just now, Medicare did not cover certain preventative services, and now they'll actually be able to receive reimbursement for those services. And also, health centers face a cap on the payment they can receive on Medicare, and that will be waived, or ended, I should say. So this is a quick pie chart of our current patient mix by insurance now and by 2015. So we'll obviously see a lot more Medicaid, but we'll also see more exchange plans. The uninsured, you saw in that past pie chart, the slice of the pie that's for uninsured patients is going to shrink a bit, but our number is still going to go up, and we'll still serve disproportionately more uninsured patients, just like all safety net providers, compared to non-safety net providers. So right now we serve about 1 in 3 of the nation's uninsured, and that's going to go up to about 1 in 7. I made a big mistake on this slide. Those M's should be B's. A recent study from George Washington University looked at the medical expenditure panel survey data from the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality and compared expenditures for patients across provider types. And they found that health centers actually save substantially and that their patients have lower expenditures compared to other patients seen elsewhere. And they attribute it to being able to reduce the risk of avoidable hospitalizations and ER visits, so not simply not going, but having their primary care or chronic conditions handled successfully in primary care, so they're not necessarily relying on the ER or costlier services. And so this is the range. It's going to be about, we anticipate a savings of $70 billion between now and 2015 with that growth chart you saw. And some of those, a lot of those savings will actually be directly affecting Medicaid programs as well. I think the maximum estimated savings is somewhere along the lines of $120 billion over 5 years. This is just a quick slide on health centers' economic impact. So obviously, as places of employment, even in healthcare providers, they're purchasing goods and services, they're hiring local members of the community, and so we've estimated in partnership with an organization called Capital Link that health centers are bringing $20 billion in economic benefits to the low-income communities they serve, and also bringing a large number of jobs as well. And again, that's through the direct and indirect purchase of goods and services. Upon expansion, with that $11 billion, the estimate is going to be about $53 billion in economic benefits supporting those communities. Just a real quick run through. We think the ARA provides some really helpful lessons as we now implement healthcare reform. Health centers, as was presented earlier, received $2 billion out of the ARA. Most of that was actually for capital programs, but a good chunk of that was also for operations. Health centers in the first 18 months of their two-year ARA period, they'd set out to reach 2.9 million new patients in the first 18 months. They already reached 2.7 million. They also have a large number of capital projects underway. And we think the most important lesson here is that when health centers will be able to rapidly put these new resources to use and start seeing patients right away. So now I'm getting back to that small print I mentioned. Obviously, I think the economy is going to be a big impact on how health centers will actually be able to continue growing. State funding is a small but still very important source of funding for health centers. And according to a state survey that we recently conducted, there's been a three-year trend in declining state revenues for health centers. It's the lowest point, I think, in 5 years for those funds. It's about a 20% decline over just the last year. And we know from other research that these sources of funding are very important not only for capacity, but also, for example, for hiring new staff. The bullet above that, I should have gone back and added, of course, is what is going to happen out of the new elections. We're still unclear how that's going to affect the safety net, but obviously we'll be paying close attention. Infrastructure and building the capacity now and getting ready for insurance expansion in 2014 is very important. The way the federal funding, you saw that chart of how it's going to be the new funding, $11 billion, how it'll play out each of the 5 years, a lot of that investment is going to happen up front because we know we have to gear up and have health centers on the ground when new patients are already, when they receive insurance, but also to make sure that patients in those communities, even if they're uninsured, have a place to go for care now. It's also important for health centers to start receiving recognition for patient-centered medical home, or what I call their hominess. We think that they already provide a lot of the different services that are actually part of the patient-centered medical home recognition process. It's part of NCQA. But there's still a lot more things that we can do to help health centers achieve that recognition. For example, more health centers do need to acquire health information technology. Health centers do need to support or help coordinating care across different providers as well. And receiving that recognition is a very important first step in being part of larger integrated networks with other providers, for example, accountable care organizations. And speaking of accountable care organizations, we do think it's important for the health center program to be very actively involved in those. They do provide important primary care services, but also oral health services, behavioral health services, and even pharmacy services for a generally underserved population who could be left out of ACO models. But we also think that the health centers will also have the capacity to be leaders in some of the ACOs as well. And it's also important for the ACOs themselves to consider the population health approach of community health centers and other safety net providers. So even though ACOs are, in theory, driven by the primary, driven by the provider, they're organized by the provider, they're still very much following the payment source. And that payment source still needs to take into account that they're uninsured and other patients with other high needs. And then, obviously, to support, to really gear up for expansion of insurance, health centers will play a big part in helping their patients acquire new insurance and navigate the new system. Health centers do rely on outstation eligibility workers for Medicaid, for example, but they're actually only funded by the state in some states instead of others. And then there, of course, like we said, they'll be remaining uninsured. And that's actually going to, we think it's still very important to be part of the health center mission, but we want to make sure that, as we expand insurance nationally and as the nation carries out healthcare reform, that we don't forget about the needs and the cost of caring for those uninsured patients. And the other thing I just want to quickly mention is that there's still a primary care workforce shortage, and that's really going to affect growth of all safety net providers. The new investments in National Service Corps are key in getting those providers in health centers, as well as the new teaching health centers component of the healthcare reform. So I think with that, I'm happy to take some questions. And I'm sorry if I talk too fast.
I had a question about the last point about National Health Service Corps. The program was largely starved by the previous administration. Now suddenly, through the era of stimulation, the healthcare reform itself, we're talking about a dramatic expansion. Now the question is what is Zach doing in terms of kind of coordinating the efforts of many providers of many states where there is an actual shortage, expecting to be a larger shortage? Because for instance, at the workshop yesterday, there were some complaints by a physician saying that there's a lot of providers that have been in that system before that have complained about not only how they got treated in that three-year period where they have to do their obligation, but also the nature of some of the rules. And what is that doing in an organized, systematic way to kind of facilitate a large number, potentially thousands, of National Health Service Corps members coming into the community health care system?
Right, and thank you for asking that question. And I should have stepped back and explained the National Service Corps is an important placement program. It's not a pipeline program. So the National Service Corps relies on people who've already made the choice to go into health professions, and particularly in primary care, and be dedicated to working in underserved communities. So I think NAC as an organization is doing this on several different fronts. We're working very closely with HRSA on, I guess being in touch with them about how those resources can actually be implemented very, very quickly. I wish our policy folks could actually be here to explain a little bit more about this. But I think part of it is actually helping HRSA get the word out, working with medical schools, for example. We're also working very closely with our health centers to make sure that they actually get their, it's a placement process, and you have to be you have to renew the number of slots, for example, you actually have available for National Service Corps members. And so unless you have that sent into HRSA, the agency that oversees the program, you will not be guaranteed those programs. So that's obviously another step. And then as part of the pipeline program, we have a number of initiatives right now. For example, there we helped create a medical school at ATCL University to encourage students to go into primary care, number one, but also be dedicated to underserved areas. And as part of their acceptance process, they need to be dedicated to working in underserved areas. In fact, there's a specific component of that medical school class that is part of it's called a homegrown program, and the health centers themselves have to nominate students. So what's happening is we're seeing a lot more people who may not have had the resources to attend medical school actually do that. And I know that there are some efforts to actually expand programs like that for nurse practitioners and others. But I think it's really about, gearing up for getting the word out for National Service Corps that there are more spaces available and people should be applying. And it's about making sure health centers are ready to take those on right now. And then, you know, we're looking at the 5-year window, but we need to think farther down, getting students as early as elementary school even ready for health professional fields.
That's great. I enjoyed your talk. I wondered at all to what extent the health centers have tried to think about ways that they could become more powerful purchasers of secondary care, specialty mm-hmm. care. You know, some of the problems sometimes are that a right. clinic is, you know, although there's lots of clinics, they're a small player in an environment and mm-hmm. they'll therefore have a lot of clout. But I've wondered about strategies of trying to, while you don't necessarily control the resource of the money that is going to go to pay the specialist, so you're not a true purchaser in that sense, I mm-hmm. wondered if there were mechanisms about creating certain ways of relationships with specialists mm-hmm. that might in fact give you a little bit more ability to try to leverage a certain quality of service back
right.
from the specialist and what thoughts you have all had around that, because mm-hmm. I fully endorse all the things going on with primary care and,
right.
and the health centers, but fundamentally you also don't want to get the patients blocked that you can't get service, and that's going
right.
to undermine your competitiveness when patients say, gee, if I can come here and get great primary care but I can't get the full range of service, I'm not sure this is the best choice for me in the long run.
Absolutely. And specialty care is actually a very large challenge in the primary care safety net. We do hope that with insurance expansion, that what we find through surveys of our members, that when a patient needs specialty care, they're more likely to get it if they have Medicare or private insurance. Medicaid, better than the uninsured, but especially if you're uninsured right now, you just have very, very little access to specialty care. And our members joke they beg, borrow, and steal to get their patients what they can. But with the expansion of insurance, hopefully that'll ensure that patients have access to broader care. But really it's about building those vertical integrated networks through ACOs or other models so that it's a health center has the ability to be fully accountable for that patient's care, coordinate that patient's care in the health center but also outside the health center. So I think we have a long way to go, but I think right now we're looking at how do we actually support health centers and build those ACOs and lead them. And I actually should add, health centers are hiring specialists themselves more and more often. In fact, when we look at the data in terms of their providers, the number of specialist physicians has doubled over the last few years. I'm sorry, last 10 years, but it's rising at a faster rate than primary care physicians in general. Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
NAC actually sits on that committee, that the negotiated rulemaking committee. So I can speak a little bit from our experience serving on that committee. It seems the committee, we still have about 4 or 5 more months to go in coming up with it, and we're a long way off in coming up with what the actual methodology would be. But the sense of it from the committee is that we need to make sure that the current safety net providers are not harmed in a designation process where they lose those designations. But moving forward, we do think that the designation process should be in the one sense easy for communities, so that communities can have the flexibility and the support from the federal government to actually be able to designate those areas themselves. But also, we need to look at need and demand broadly. So we need, when we're looking at how, for example, the medically underserved areas are designated, that the actual items that are part of that process hasn't changed in years, we need to account for other factors. For example, uninsured is not part of that. Obviously, we need to do it in a way where the data exists, but NAC is also open to having allowing communities the flexibility of including their own data, but it's something that will be discussed further as we go along.
Mm-hmm. My understanding is that the primary care providers have their malpractice actually paid for
right.
UHCs. Is that true also for the specialists that are practicing?
Well, it's interesting you should ask that. It is not. However, if it's what a health center can do is hire, say, a quarter FTE of a specialist time, and that person would have their their Federal Tort Claims Act medical malpractice covered. The Senate actually recently passed legislation to allow health centers to cover FDCA for volunteers. So I think legislation like that would open a lot of doors, and I neglected to mention that.
I'd like to say thank you very much to Professor Kruger. We have just another couple minutes. If there are any questions, that maybe we can open up to the panel of speakers. If there's anything that you wanted to ask and didn't have a chance to yet.
I had a question primarily for Dr. Bynum, but some of you mentioned this as well, which is the ability to leverage some of the R dollars, particularly if anything is going to health information exchanges. Because it seems like integration across providers over time as people are moving in and out of Medicare, ESI, and uninsured status. How do you do that if you have an EHR that is tethered to a provider versus a PHR, and what are states then doing with their HIE and their RA dollars?
Yeah. So you've identified the problem. I mean, this is another one where it's a tremendous opportunity to, I mean, there's a lot of money obviously going into HIT right now, but the challenge on the ground is getting coordinated in a way to maximize this integration phenomenon. And I think some communities have been more ahead than others in terms of getting a sort of umbrella entity that has sort of thought about these issues and who's working with who and what's the nature of the compatibility they need to have. It is very hard, as your question sort of gets at, to make these decisions in isolation because, you know, you're even though the meaningful use aspects of these things is intended to create enhanced capabilities to be able to communicate across different organizations, still fundamentally we know that it's going to take a while, you know, to be able to work that out. And I, again, from my own experience in San Francisco, believe very strongly that when you have a local entity that is seen as a neutral convener, that can go a long way in trying to get the parties to recognize that their self-interests around trying to sort of make a decision about their own organization, sometimes, you know, if they can look around and understand the issues of this connectedness with who they really need to work with, that they may make sometimes different decisions as a group. But that's very hard to do. I mean, the money is coming now, or is about to come, fast and furious, right? I mean, it's just around the corner. And so having that ability to try to organize that is so critical, I think on the ground. There will be some benefit because, like I said, the meaningful use will sort of help to make up for some of these mistakes over time in terms of standardizing the data that will allow for some of that exchange. Your question really holds the answer, which is that if you don't sort of think about how you're going to organize the technology is just going to make a faster mess as opposed to a cleared up one. Yeah, Gil, you had a...
Right. Folks in California, there's actually 16 consortiums.
Right.
And they are just playing a coordinating role for the clinics. Just recently, the clinics were able to get about $20 billion of these funds, innovation funds. And it was, in every case, it was a network of clinics that actually competed for that money and got it. So I think the idea is building the stream by pulling together multiple sets of clinics that have more of a capacity.
Right. Now, again, that will get at some of the horizontal issues potentially, but it doesn't necessarily solve the vertical integration
right.
challenges. And so, I mean, there's strength in that, but it's also, we can also reflect on some of the limitations of how, if you want to have...
hospitals actually linking in with
right.
the networks as
right.
well.
Yeah.
That's where the real vertical integration
right.
comes from.
On one of those topics, I apologize for
thinking
about this, but I'm thinking about the was we've begun to do is really work with our state, and our state actually took Medicaid data. What we realized is that in order to get the integration, we pulled together through the auspices actually of public health. They actually took the lead, working with, in Seattle, our community health centers are 330 FQHCs. And then some of the key safety net providers, so Harvard is a public hospital, and we see a lot of the emergency department, as well as clinical care and mental health. And the health department, then working with the state, identified the highest providers, the number of providers that provide the most services to the safety community, and then pulled together using a neutral private nonprofit, pulled together the players, including mental health and substance abuse, because that was the other entity
outcomes, we saw huge, obviously, overlap between ED, pharmaceutical use, et cetera. And people, particularly the providers, the two key conveners are two of the physicians, the head of psychiatry and our primary care medical director. So I really urge you to look at who are really seeing the clients, and then that's driving some motivation, as well as the structures.
Thank you. Well, I would like to thank all of our speakers. We had a really wonderful panel this morning, so I'd like to have a round of applause for all our speakers.